Well, good evening, everybody, on Overtime. Did we all make it? Everybody make it okay? Rob, Gil, you there?
We are present and accounted for.
Awesome. Alex has an empty chair. Where's Alex? He disappeared. And Voltaire disappeared as well. You know, people, you can't just walk away for Overtime. On the show, you have to. Contract says you have to be on Overtime as well. So
we're going to have a meeting. Actually,
we're going to have that. This could be the meeting.
We're going to have a discussion about this when we're not live.
You know, we had a whole bunch of people waiting, and as soon as we started talking, listeners dropped. Well, what are you disappointed? That's what you think was going to happen. Okay. Again, our phone number 802-321-HACK 802-321-4225. Go ahead.
Finish the number.
I did.
Oh, sorry.
802-321-4225.
And that stands for hack, right?
Yes.
I wanted to mention the Enron email corpus came up with our guests during the show, and I would have said, and I'm going to say it now, that we actually had a talk about that in 2018 at the Circle of Hope. And the title of the talk is The Enron Email Corpus, Where the Bodies Are Buried. And the name of the presenter is David Noever. And you can find that at channel 2600 on YouTube.
Okay.
Along with all of our other Hope presentations.
Now, Rob, I'm going to ask you, can you verify that we are, in fact, on YouTube and it's working? Because sometimes it's not working, we don't know it, and I did notice our listenership dropped in half the first two minutes we started talking. Okay. So hopefully it's just a technical issue that will soon be fixed. Alex, you're back. Welcome back. Glad you could fit us in.
Oh, anytime. Only a pleasure.
That was a really interesting guest, Sam.
No doubt.
The Zoom meetings that are being screwed up now as a result of his efforts, I think that's definitely a feather in your cap.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, to an extent, and you know, I think he's done a great thing, and I expect great things to come from him as well. I mean, he's got a very innovative way and of looking at things, and I think just a different perspective on where technology fits into our lives. And that's a really interesting perspective to me, and I hope that our listeners found it to be so as well.
Yeah, it ties into our theme of basically taking control of technology and shaping it to do what you want to do, not the other way around. And too often we get pulled into that where we have to answer the call, we have to be available. And that's nonsense. You don't have to do that. You can do whatever you want. That's why, I told American Express to take a hike. Well, I didn't actually tell them that, but I'm going to if they keep asking me for information they don't have a right to. You don't have to be at a certain place at a certain time if that is not convenient for you. So it's power I think people don't realize they have. And unfortunately, it's hammered into our heads that you have to conform. You don't have to conform.
Yeah, don't be so cooperative.
No. Stop being cooperative, listeners.
Or reasonable.
Yes. Please call us. 802-321-4225. This is why we have Overtime, is so that our listeners can call in. Since we're not in the studio and we can't actually take phone calls live on the air, we can do it here. And it's a great system that we have rigged up, and things seem to work for the most part.
I love the interview with Sam, too, to learn more about the stuff that just really wasn't covered in the media, which were his earlier projects about slowing down your computer, deliberately and intentionally slowing down your computer. And it's like, hey, when he described it in a way, I kind of get it. I understand. Slowing down your computer may actually give you back some of your life, in a sense. So, it's really one way of looking at it. And that, and then the Enron corpus of emails that Kyle was just talking about as well. I think that's just such a fascinating body of emails, and the idea that getting another one or two of those sent to you every day is pretty unique as well. And then bringing up the fact that those emails coming in can actually poison your own data set. That's something I think that we're going to be revisiting over the next couple of years for sure, which is how do we get out of this era where everything about us is known, where we can be psychologically prodded and tweaked because we've given away so much information about ourselves. Well, the only way to do that, the only way to take back control of our data set is perhaps to poison it, in a sense, to make it unusable for those who would seek to use data mining or big data techniques in order to psychologically exploit the data that we have given to third parties for so many years. You have laws in California like the CCPA, you've got GDPR. All of this is designed to give consumers back power over their own data to re-enhance, I think, our concept and our reasonable expectation of privacy, or what can be done in our names with our data, with or without our consent. But to a certain extent, these laws don't have a lot of bite. They don't have a lot of teeth. If you think about the CCPA, we can get information about where your data has gone, but the law does not require those who are in control of your data to actually describe the organizations to which it was specifically provided. They only have to describe categories. So if we are trying to take back control for the consumer over their data, that falls short. So I think the notion of poisoning your own data set and making it unusable is going to come up time and time again over the next several years.
All right. It's good standard operating, just in general, obfuscate. I remember a cafe that had a little sign I used to frequent, and it said, we reserve the right to confuse service.
Mm-hmm. I believe we have a phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook Overtime.
Yes, hi. I wanted to say one thing in defense of online conferences instead of in-person conferences.
Okay.
The chat threads are amazing in terms of the information that people often post there, the links to articles and other resources and tools.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing I regret about this online hope that took place back in 2020 was the chat threads, as far as I know, were not archived. And I think, as I said, there's a lot of great information there. And I'd encourage listeners to feel free to maybe set up a website and post those chat threads so that people that weren't able to attend a meeting, you know, a specific talk or workshop, they could get that information. What do you think of that idea?
I'm not entirely sure they weren't archived. I'd have to check on that, but it seems sound to me.
Were you an attendee, and did you use our chat system?
Yeah. But okay. As I said, I mean, one person can only attend so many so many different events, and obviously you had several things that were occurring simultaneously, and I wasn't able to coordinate with other people. But like I said, those chat threads were fantastic, and some of them were just amazing. I mean, the things that people were throwing in there, these resources I'd never heard of before. And like I said, I think it would be great to continue to offer people maybe with the next hope, offer people the option of attending virtually if they wanted to.
Well, we've definitely learned a lot as far as virtual conferences versus physical conferences. And yeah, it's never going to be the same again, never going to be entirely the same again. We will have in-person conferences, but there will certainly be more of an online connection as well. We just have to figure out what the best proportion is.
Yeah, we don't want all of that stuff to complement as best we can imagine, and we look back even at what we were planning, and some of the emphasis, I think, in what we learned has changed. We may put more into that given the successes we had. And your idea about the chats, I'm thinking we'll check on that. I like the concept of a static copy of it for attendees. And I think that if you are able to log back into the service as it's been archived, there is a possibility that those are there. But it would not surprise me if it has been put into a state where it's not quite the same as when it was being hosted, for obvious reasons. A lot of the infrastructure and stuff was temporary borrowed and we got a lot of help insofar as those donations. So
it's the kind of thing where somebody, if they just took it on, they could be the person in charge of archiving it. It probably was something that just way too many things for us to worry about and was overlooked. That's entirely possible.
And in a related vein, I mean, we for the first time did a lot more with transcribing and getting captions for most of the talks, and that is still, I believe, something that is ongoing or that we could put more resources into as well. And that in and of itself is a form of log for people who maybe are unable to listen or watch the talk in a way that most of us do. And we want to increase the accessibility, and having sort of static files like that is a great idea, but it takes energy, and as volunteers, we only have so much over the course of time.
Alex, you had a point?
Yeah, I'm actually on the Matrix chat right now, by the way, and there's still people on there chatting. You know, you can send a message, and somebody will respond. You know, there are still people out there that are on the Matrix chat, and it's pretty awesome. The other thing I wanted to note for the caller as well is that I'm actually seeing that I can scroll backwards, and I'm using a desktop version of the client right now. I can scroll backwards and go back very, very, very far. So, for instance, I'm looking at, you know, random right now, the random room, and it shows that there's 1.2 thousand messages that I haven't read in random, and I can just keep scrolling back, scrolling back, scrolling back. So, absolutely, if somebody wanted to archive this, in fact, I'd be surprised if somebody hasn't already, but it's there. It's there, and it's ripe for the taking.
Okay, well, that's great. I just wanted to put it out there. I think it's great information. I'm a completist. I believe
agreed.
In archiving as much information as possible, whether it's the written word, the spoken word, or the audio or the video. The more, unless, you know, respecting people's privacy, obviously, but if somebody's okay with it, I believe in archiving every second,
yeah.
Every word, every syllable, and every second of audio and video. So you guys keep up the great work. Thank you.
Well, I think it's an important point that you made, too, because, you know, there really was a completely different angle to this conference this past year, given those conversations that happened online. I think we learned a lot from that, and I'm sure that we'll have some component of this going forward. So thank you so much for the call and for your comments.
I just really would like to emphasize that the channel is the best place to look for transcriptions of chats and stuff, because that is for attendees. It would be nice to have a static log in some place, but it's not something that we necessarily have designed to be posted publicly. So I don't know if we can... We haven't thought about how exactly we would archive that, and it was never intended to be something public. So I don't want to give anybody the impression
that... It got more successful than we were planning on being. People really wanted to stick around.
It was for Q&A.
And the fact that Alex is able to be in there right now and still talk to people at the conference, that's incredible. That is amazing. We're thrilled by that. And I think Matrix was a great choice, too. You know, everyone basically trying to... suggest other commercial products, Discord server and that kind of thing, which are great, but I think Matrix had something different. I think it really had its own unique flair.
And it's certainly something we can build upon in the future, so we're excited to explore it a little bit more and see where it takes us.
All right, our phone line is open, 802-321-4225. If you're an off-the-hook listener or somebody just wants to share something with us or ask a question, please feel free. You know, I have an update for a story that we alluded to last week. Remember, we were talking about the surveillance cameras that were hacked. Well, Tilly Kotman is a 21-year-old hacker who has taken credit for intrusions at major U.S. companies like Nissan, Intel, and California-based security camera company last week that Kotman claimed. Well, federal prosecutors in Western Washington have secured a grand jury indictment last week against the Swiss national. They allege that Kotman, in concert with others online, acquired stolen credentials and accessed protected systems to steal confidential records and code. The stolen data was hosted on a private website that's been seized by the FBI, as well as on Telegram and other services. That's according to charging papers. Prosecutors say notable targets include a security device company, a tactical equipment maker, an automobile manufacturer, and a financial investment firm. A website run by the hackers is at one point said to have held data from over 100 companies, including Adobe, Toyota, Pepsi, Microsoft, AMD, Motorola, GE Appliances, Disney, Nintendo, and more. Cyber Intel news site The Record reports that Kotman relied on misconfiguration to gain access to protected data and link them to an FBI industry alert in October warning of hackers capitalizing on default password settings in corporate and government software. Honestly, folks, I don't see what they did that is worthy of this kind of a reaction. It's not like, from what I'm reading, it's not like this was held hostage, this person acted as many criminals do and tried to use ransomware against these companies. They were open, honest about it, and humorous at the same time. These things need to be known. If there are security holes like this, they're still going to be there whether or not make fools of the companies. It's I think the way it was done right. I don't know. That's just my feeling about how security holes should be revealed. If something like this, where your private information is being left out in the open, you have the right to know about that. The company is not going to tell you. So somebody who figures out how to do it and can demonstrate it to the world, I think that is a service. Alex, how about you? What do you think?
Well, look, I think you got to look at the indictment specifically, right? And I have some very specific thoughts and views on this particular case as well. But perhaps I shouldn't say too much, because the first count in the indictment is conspiracy to commit computer fraud and abuse. That would be under the CFAA, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. That's essentially accessing a computer without authorization. And so this is a conspiracy charge there. The other two that seem particularly flimsy here, the other counts, are wire fraud, right, which is some the count two is conspiracy to commit wire fraud, which is essentially, using the wire system to willfully devise and execute or attempt to execute a scheme to defraud.
It's a very easy charge to be hit with.
Yeah, no doubt. And then counts 3 through 7 are, in fact, wire fraud and the scheme to defraud, the manner and means. I mean, some of this seems particularly flimsy. It seems like it was put together very, very quickly. And my understanding of what Tilley had done in order to identify these vulnerabilities was to look at places like GitHub and other source code repositories for code that was unintentionally made public, that companies had put out there without the without meaning to make it public. And when you find source code that was unintendedly made public, you're going to find certain vulnerabilities. And mm-hmm. It was the exploitation of those vulnerabilities to make them public that resulted in the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act charges here. Now, this reminded me quite a bit, if you think about, it's one thing, I guess, to access something without authorization, but it's another thing to make public that which is already public. Right? And I think to a very large extent, that was the intention behind the actions here.
To make public what is already public?
That's right. Yeah. To make it more public.
More public.
Widely known, the fact that there are these exploitable vulnerabilities out there in public source code, in source code repositories like GitHub mm-hmm. and elsewhere.
If you don't demonstrate it in a way people can understand, they're not going to realize the gravity of the situation. They're not going to say, hey, this security camera is capturing people inside a hospital, patients inside a hospital. We should know about that, that kind of thing is wide open and can be accessed legally by all kinds of people, but should be accessed by them anyway. But the fact that they have it so that anyone can access that, I don't think that should be protected. I don't think that's something that you have to think of their feelings or their corporate value and be part of the conspiracy to keep quiet about it. I think what they did here was the responsible thing, sharing it with the world, because I'll bet it gets fixed now.
Well, it certainly will. But the idea that this information and these vulnerabilities were already out there in the wild, I think, could be legally significant. I think this is going to be an incredibly interesting case to watch
mm-hmm.
because it reminds me a lot, in certain respects, of the Knight Lightning case. Do you remember that one?
Oh, boy, do I. 1990.
Yeah, 1990. So we're talking about 31 years ago, and Knight Lightning, whose real name, I believe, was Craig Nydorf, right?
Still is.
He was one of the original publishers of FRAC,
mm-hmm.
right, which is an electronic, it was a text file hacking magazine that existed way back in the, and I think the late 80s and the 90s, but way up until
still exists.
You know, the mid to late 90s, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was around for quite a while.
It's
I remember
still around.
Track.
Alex, it's still around. It doesn't come out that often, but it does come out.
Oh, I had no idea. That's news to me. That's pretty awesome.
You've
I'd love
fallen off the subscription list. So,
But the issue with the Night Lightning or the Craig Nydorf case was he was charged with essentially exfiltrating these incredibly expensive to develop and highly confidential Bell System documents that related to the E911 system,
uh-huh.
if I recall correctly. Now, those documents, it turns out, and it came out during trial, that the Bell System had claimed were, in fact, private and confidential, were actually available for purchase to the public. They were already out there in the public domain
mm-hmm.
that I think you could buy for $11 or $12.
14, I believe, was the number. But yeah, and as soon as that was revealed, they had to retreat and drop the case. But the damage had been done. Craig Nydorf's family was devastated with the expense of having to defend him and keep their son out of prison. It's a good example of how these corporations abuse the power that they have and lie. They just absolutely lie. So we saw the same thing with the Kevin Mitnick case, where the source code for cellular code was basically seen as worth millions and millions of dollars, and it was nothing like that. It was given away for free.
Wasn't it Motorola source code?
That was one of them.
But I know he was using an Oki.
We have a caller that's been waiting patiently. Caller, I'm sorry. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
I wish you had a local phone number so I wouldn't be racking up long-distance charges waiting.
You really have a long-distance plan? I didn't think people still had long-distance plans.
Yes, I do.
Wow.
And
well, I'm sorry. Get us a 212 number, and we'll be happy to use that instead. But this is a cool one. It spells hack. Nothing is actually in Vermont. 802 is the area code for Vermont.
Yeah. Well, get a local phone number. It doesn't have to be 212.
All right, 646-917.
Any of the local ones.
Wow.
I'm not picky.
But there's somebody in Vermont that's happy that we have a local number for them.
But you're making long-distance charges for your...
I honestly did not think there was still such a thing as long-distance charges. What company do you use that still charges you long-distance to call Vermont?
I can't remember where I originally got it, but it's bundled through... another company. What difference does it make to you? I'd give you the information.
Well, other than complaining about the number that you called in on, is there anything that you'd like to share with us?
Yes. I was hoping to hear from Huge Ma this evening.
I'm sorry. I was distracted for a second.
TurboVax?
Say that again.
TurboVax. Huge Ma, the person who created TurboVax.
Yes.
I was hoping to hear from him on the show this evening.
Okay.
Anti-Asian hate and such.
Okay, I'm not sure where you got the idea he was going to be on the show, but Rob, did you have something?
His name, which I believe is pronounced Huge Ma. He's the person who made TurboVax and momentarily took it offline to draw attention to the anti-Asian murders and anti-Asian sentiment that had been going on in this country that unfortunately is very much still a problem, and using his platform to raise awareness. And that is something that that is very important to us here, and it's something that we continue to keep an eye on. We had not, arranged an appearance or an interview. We don't know if he'd be into such a thing, but we are definitely very much interested in keeping an eye on the issue and similar situations in which people who find themselves with elevated voices are able to use that to get their messages across, like he did.
Well, he is interested in raising the profile of this issue, so I'm sure if you asked him, he would be delighted.
Alex, it looked like you had something to say.
No, I'm okay. Just listening to the caller.
All right, I was waiting for you. Okay, well, caller, we'll take that under advisement, but thanks for the suggestion. Anything else that you wanted to share with us?
What?
Is there anything else you want to share with us?
Yeah, you have a delay between what you're saying and when it's broadcasting. You know, when I'm on the phone, I notice there's a delay. Like,
there's a delay at the station, yes, there always has been.
Ah, okay. It just seemed weird to me because, you know, at the station when you're broadcasting over the air, you want to be able to prevent people saying things that would get the station in trouble.
Right, and we can at the station.
Words, but you're not broadcasting.
Yeah, well, obviously, but we can't control the delay system remotely. We can control the delay system when we're at the station. But, you know, if somebody were to say something, then we'd have 7 seconds to wait for it to go out over the air, but we wouldn't be able to stop it. Unless, of course, we have an engineer in the studio that is basically hanging on our every word, and we'll be able to judge that and censor it in time. It's a lot, you know, it's more complicated than it needs to be.
Okay. Well, you know, that's interesting to learn about.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're here to share information.
It's like 20 seconds rather than 7, though.
Uh-huh. Well, that's you're listening on the internet now, so that could take even longer.
Right.
Anyway, listen, we want to open up the phones to more people. Thank you for calling in, and best of luck.
Bye.
So we were talking about the case. Again, our phone number, 802-321-4225. Yes, long-distance charges may apply if you're in the 1980s with Verizon or something like that. No, they didn't exist back then. But we were talking about the case with surveillance cameras that was revealed a couple of weeks ago. Alex, this is a Swiss national who's been indicted. Is that going to affect them? Can they be brought to this country?
Possibly, because the first battle here is going to be a battle over extradition. You have the indictment in the Western District of Washington, and the U.S. government and the Department of Justice is going to have to make a case over to the Swiss authorities that Tilly, a foreign national, should be extradited to the United States to face these charges.
And why is it the Western District of Washington?
Well, apparently that's where the situs of some of the crime happened, or some of the acts that gave rise to the CFAA case, the Fraud and Abuse Act case, actually occurred. I don't know exactly what the jurisdictional nexus is to the Western District of Washington, but that's where the case is brought. So
could it be, you know, that's where Microsoft, that's where Amazon, that's where all these companies
Adobe.
Are? Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, that's
a lot of their systems, a lot of the data centers there in Kent and all over southern downtown and up in Redmond, obviously. But that whole western part of the state has a lot of infrastructure that's important to those companies, as does California, New York. You know, big cities tend to attract that kind of business these days.
Okay, we have another phone call. Let's go back to the phones. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
Pretty good. I had a question about the contest that was run about 11 years ago for the Next Hope.
A contest 11 years ago? Boy, you're a late entry.
What's the question?
Oh, no, I won.
Oh, you won. Well, congratulations.
I am one of the successful candidates for the Next Hope.
Wow. Well, that's great. I hope you you benefited from that. What did we ask you to do, and what did you do?
It was effectively an internet scavenger hunt.
Okay.
We've done some of those.
Yeah.
And the prize, which, from what I remember on the show at the time, only 30 people made it. The prize was a private Facebook group that we don't really use.
Okay. That was the prize? A private? That's not a good prize. Wow.
I didn't make the contest.
Uh-huh.
Well, it may not have been us directly either, so we'll have to check on that. Is that really, that was what your prize was?
I don't remember this.
Is this group still accessible, and what do you talk about other than how crappy the prize was?
I don't think so. But I mean, the group is accessible, but I don't think anyone talks. No, it was one of the hacked websites that you did, and you had to go into the source code, and then you had to find capitals of countries,
oh, wow.
Georgia specifically. Then you had to dial automated a line, not leave a message, listen to this, reverse speech. It was excellent.
We did this? Wow, I'm impressed.
I kind of vaguely remember this, but this was a very long time ago. This was
it was April 1st, 2010.
Sure, sure.
And we did it on April 1st, too?
Because at the time... You were either redirecting your site to, like, let's say the FBI or just hacking it in general.
I think we had an ICE page up for a while.
We've done things like that for sure.
And what I remembered was it was a 24-hour period in, at least Eastern Standard Time, that you had to complete all of the tasks. And I heard there were hundreds of entries, but only 30 people won.
You know what? I think I remember this. Were there allusions to the TV program Lost in it?
That I don't know because I didn't watch Lost, so I wasn't sure.
Uh-huh. Well, did you get different emails saying you are a candidate or something like that?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, that's right.
I do remember
that
this
now. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. But I don't remember the details. So that's really awesome.
I don't
awesome.
Remember all the details either, but it was just entertaining
mm-hmm.
to have that.
Well, we're glad we can entertain people. That's always awesome to be able to do that. And
can I just ask, what made you think of this?
Yeah, why now?
I'm a frequent listener, subscriber, and all of that. So I just figured I don't really call into radio shows because it makes me nervous. But I figured the internet is less so.
Yeah, this isn't technically a radio show anymore, so you don't have to be nervous.
Well, that's true. Yeah. But I just thought of it, and the reason I thought of the past was because you were doing the phone messages
you
had that you corrected the audio with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured it was just something else to mention.
Yeah, that's great. No, thanks for the memory and bringing our own puzzles back to us. We love doing that kind of stuff, especially around, of course, April 1st, but then... the event itself, we've done all kinds of different puzzles.
Holy crap, April 1st is around the corner.
Don't worry about it, we'll get to that. It's
we have nothing planned, Kyle.
Well,
we always
sure
have to do something.
People can write us, they can always email oth@2600.com.
If you have an idea for what we can do for April 1st to spread cheer and joy throughout the world, please email us, oth@2600.com. Caller, what part of the world are you based in?
Just over the river. I'm in Jersey.
Oh, Jersey. How is Jersey doing throughout this dark period?
Well, they stopped banging pots at about 8 o'clock.
Remember that? That was it 8 or was it 7?
They did that about a month.
I thought it was 7 o'clock. Maybe that's why everybody gave me dirty looks. Banging
well,
my pots
no, here it was a different time.
Uh-huh.
Oh, so it was 8 in Jersey,
why.
It was 7
because New York and New Jersey can never agree on anything.
Okay, well.
Why should they agree on that?
I occasionally send you guys notes when you're not on the air.
Oh,
okay.
So we've corresponded.
I'm back.
All right, and how have you fared?
I've had COVID twice. And
whoa! Hold on. So you've had COVID twice? I don't think I've talked to anybody who's had COVID twice.
Jeez, Louise!
Yes.
How did you manage that?
Well, the first time I couldn't get a test because no one could
mm-hmm.
at that time.
Right.
That was the end of March. A year ago. And then the second time. I was diagnosed in January of this year,
uh-huh.
and they gave me a course of steroids and things of that nature, and then I ended up in the hospital 2 weeks later with a high heart rate and things of that nature. But they treated me, and I'm doing well, but I actually can't get a vaccine until May because they want me to wait from having COVID to getting the vaccine.
Right.
Yeah, I've heard of that from a few people. It does make sense. But the important thing is that you get that vaccine when it's time for you to do that.
Yeah, certainly
will.
My wife has already gotten her first shot.
Okay. Do you know how you were exposed?
I don't, actually. I mean, I'm the only one who leaves the apartment usually because I have a manual, so I drive around in that, so I get the groceries and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably how I did it.
But you were wearing masks the whole time, I would imagine, right?
Of course, yes. I don't use my Hope mask, but I do have it.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the Hope mask as your only mask. That's like a decorative mask. But, yeah, we've been wearing two masks the whole time. And, you know, I got an antibody test before I got my vaccine, and I came out negative, which is good. So that means something must have worked. But it's really something to hear from someone who's been through this twice and actually was hospitalized. But you sound great. You sound like you really are making it through this. And I just hope the day comes where we can all be in attendance at a conference in person together.
Well, that would be excellent.
All right. Well, congratulations on being one of the winners of the conference 11 years ago, or the contest. And
thank you. And
please stay in touch and send us whatever you come across.
Maybe the Facebook group can become a puzzle team for the next one or something.
Yeah, we'll see.
That would work.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to remember more of this. Thank you again for your call.
Thank you.
Take
have
care.
A good one.
Wow, interesting call, huh?
Yeah, that's amazing that the caller has had COVID twice, and you know, I'm glad they're still okay, and you know, quit hogging the pandemic, save some for other people. But
no, please don't do that. The thing is, you can still get COVID, folks. It's not too late. You can still get it. It's very possible, and especially if you don't take precautions. Not that this person didn't take precautions. It happened to people who do take precautions, but for those people down in Florida and Texas and other places. It makes me so angry because all the work that people are doing around the world, it's for naught if there are people who ignore that or minimize it, you know? The president of Tanzania recently died, a COVID denier. He died of COVID. You know, that says it all. How many idiotic leaders have we seen over the past couple of years that have tried to minimize the danger and have put their own people at risk and are responsible for thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of people dying and certainly getting sick. You know, I like to think that we've learned something and we're moving forward, but then I see what's going on in some of these states, and it really, you know, it makes me sad and angry. And if we don't get back to normal this year, that's why. That's why. It's not for the scientists, not trying their best. It's not for people who are taking precautions. It's for those who think there's a conspiracy around every corner, or that they're being lied to, or that they're somehow able to not be affected by a disease. It's crazy.
Yeah, and uncooperative. Could you check the telephone lines for us? Let's see.
We think that might be a call?
I don't know. I didn't drop it. Let's see if someone's there. Otherwise,
okay.
I'll drop this.
All right. Is anybody there?
Hi.
Oh, there is somebody there. Yes, go ahead. Where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from New York. I'm stuck in the city, but I enjoy listening to your show on Wednesday. But I had two questions for you. One that's like stuck in the back of my head, and the other one was something Alex said earlier about mixing up your data, and I was wondering how he would suggest doing that. And then my second question for you is about children. So I see everyone posting their children on Instagram, on Facebook. They're creating individual profiles for them. And so I'm wondering if you guys think that they're creating, like, almost artificial profiles for these kids, and that by the time they're 18, they'll have, like, in-depth, I guess, like, social profiles.
Alex, I'm going to let you take this one.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the first question that the caller had asked was about poisoning one's own data set. And I think that, you know, for a lot of people, we've had social media accounts going back to as far back as 2006, right? You know, we're talking about 15 years ago, I think were some of the earliest Facebook accounts. And so that's a lot of data. That's a massive amount of data. If you were actually to download that data and print it out, it would be a hugely voluminous amount of data, more than any intelligence agency on the planet would ever compile in a dossier about you. So just in terms of privacy and the psychology about which these companies have been compiling data is really, it's through the roof. And so how do we get control of that data again? How do we do that? I mean, how do we make this data not relevant to advertisers? There's, you know, you can opt out of targeted advertising, but there's still a huge amount of data that's going to be collected about you based on where your phone is, what apps you're using. And, you know, basically anything you do on your phone can be logged. So taking that data and taking external data, putting it into that data set, that data or that data subset, is going to change your profile. So, you know, let's say you have a whole bunch of bogus Amazon emails coming into your Gmail account that are talking about the purchasing of adult diapers, let's just say, right? That might not jive with the profile that the social media companies or any of these targeted advertisers have about you being, let's say, somebody in your early 30s or in your 20s or in fact, having children. You know, so there's lots of different ways that you can trick them into making that data not as useful as it was in the past. And I think that there will probably be more technological means to do this on a more massive scale coming forward over the next few years. And that's especially, I think, if these technology companies and social media platforms resist regulation or resist any kind of oversight and also refuse to acknowledge liability for certain things like causing an insurrection or massive amounts of misinformation and deceptive advertising during perhaps the 2016 election. So that's, you know, the first question about poisoning the data set. The second question, I think, was about children and putting the faces of children online. You have a great amount of pause, and I think that's an extraordinarily interesting question as well, because I have two children, and I've only ever put one of their faces on social media, and I think it's for the exact reasons that you said, caller, which is that we don't want to have our children out there on social media and have their faces recognized by these algorithms before they even have a social media account. And, you know, there are a massive amount of data scrapers that go out and look for publicly available pictures, information, perform facial recognition. They may be creating, they certainly are. There are companies that are creating huge databases of facial recognition data that are then sold to government agencies, law enforcement, and quite likely other foreign countries as well. And if you think about, you know, let's say, you know, my 7-year-old son, who maybe at one point later on in his life will become some kind of political activist, or any of us really, you know, let's say we want to, you know, work with Human Rights First and trying to combat the terrible treatment that China is perpetuating with respect to the Uyghurs, but yet you may have to travel to China for business for one particular reason or another. Having your face out there on social media is going to allow you to be tracked. And so there are a lot of implications, I think, when it comes to who you are, what you do, where you can be tracked, and your reasonable expectations of privacy. And I think that as well, you know, children, when I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, we had a different conception of privacy. We had a different conception of what it meant to have a reasonable expectation of privacy. My 7-year-old son notices surveillance cameras when we go into stores, and that's just part of his life. And he loves to point them out and find where they are. He's got a hacker mentality just like me. But growing up with surveillance cameras all around you definitely changes what you believe to be your reasonable expectation of privacy. And I think it detracts from one's life in a great sense, too, because when I was a kid growing up, I could get away with a lot of stuff. I knew I wasn't being watched all the time. I knew I wasn't being tracked all the time. And so I think it really curtails your freedom. It curtails your sense of adventure as well.
Yeah. And the biggest things that I think about with this sort of thing are the fact that so many of these social media sites, well, first, it's in their terms of service that if you're below a certain age, you're not supposed to be using the service. And so when parents are okay with it and do it anyway, you know, that's a decision that you're making for your child before your child is informed enough and of a maturity level to make that decision for themselves. And there are so many things that, like, as Alex said, you know, my generation of kids could get away with, could do and then have forgotten as part of like the mistakes you make when you're growing up that just aren't possible now. And I know there are so many things that I am glad there was not the modern social media sphere or the modern web around when I did them, because I was able to grow and learn from these things without having it permanently archived somewhere that comes up every time I'm in a job interview. So there's that whole angle to this sort of thing where you are putting something out there that you no longer control. Anybody can archive it. Anybody can copy it. Anybody can feed it through some, you know, whatever systems, whatever algorithms to further identify and track your child. And I'm saying that is really a decision, I believe, that is best made by the person involved, by the kid, when they're old enough to make this decision.
And I would agree with that. I also think that, you know, I've got friends who started Facebook pages for their children when their children were named. So sometimes these kids have Facebook pages before they're even extant, which also just weirds me out on a personal level. But, you know, when you have a picture, like, you're going to hand this child a Facebook profile when they are old enough to manage it on their own. And that also just terrifies me. I mean, if you want to document your child's growth, I think a photo album might be a nice option, perhaps better than a Facebook page. At the other end of it, when my brother and sister-in-law had a child, they embargoed us from putting the child on social media, and they actually both deactivated all their social media accounts. So, you know, our baby nephew does not exist in social media. It's just kind of amazing.
Good for him.
Yeah. And there are still ways that you can do, like, digitally document this kid's life for the family, as you would in a photo album, as you would to share with, you know, your relatives, the people in your child's life. There are ways to do that on a private level without putting it out there through, you know, through some social media companies that, you know, have all sorts of things in mind to do with that data.
And the game is kind of stacked against you even to just take a private photo, because a lot of people are using smartphones to take the photos in the first place. That can often be connected with a service or something external to the device that you're capturing that memory on. And so just even having stuff privately, it's and keeping it secure for your family is a task in and of itself. So there's as many strategies as you can think of, and I think it's up to parents individually to come up with something suitable that they're comfortable with. And also just allowing young people to gravitate towards that stuff on their own, I think, is as much as our generation was given as far as opportunities. Like, we didn't have as much of this pervasive surveillance capitalism when we were coming of age, and then when this stuff was available, we were probably old enough to adopt it or not, or choose how we use it. Where you're doing this, as Gia talked about and we were saying, like, before they're actually little people yet, it just completely hijacks their ability to curate that identity. And I would qualify that by pointing out, on the flip side, just how much pressure there is at ever younger ages for them to curate a social media profile. In other words, their concepts of success nowadays are, I have to be an influencer, I have to be a child athlete, I have to be excellent at this and have all these followers and be really skilled. And there's so much pressure already on young people to then have a psychotic social media platform there taunting them with their insecurities and what their peers are doing better, I think is a certain kind of hell that you're indenturing them to.
I had so much trouble with bullies when I was growing up. I can't even imagine how I would fit in cyberbullying as well. You know, what kids have to deal with these days, we should always celebrate when they rebel against this, when they say, I don't want to be on Facebook, I don't want a social media profile, I don't care about influencing. You know, this is not for me. I just want to go out and play ball or something.
And one last thing is, with video games and with all of these technologies, I saw something the World Health Organization put out recently, and I think other groups would advocate this, is that young people need experienced guides when they're using technology, including video games, including the Internet. They need people there who are older, who know the technology, parents, you know, other role models and influencers in their lives that can help them make sense of all
good
of
influencers,
it.
Not the
well, yeah.
Stupid influencers.
Nah, that's up to parents to
decide.
They
ruined that word. That word is destroyed for me.
I don't mean influencer. I mean role model. What is a...
Yeah, role model. But a role model that can also appreciate kids doing their own thing and going in a totally different direction. I appreciate that.
I know there's a word. There's a chaperone. Someone that can let them explore, mm-hmm. but be there to help interpret.
Caller, have we begun to address some of your concerns or questions?
Beautifully, yes. Now the kids on Instagram, really, it's haunting because my parents never had social media, never posted a picture of me. They showed pictures of me to everyone, naked pictures, which I didn't appreciate when I was like 10, but I couldn't imagine waking up and seeing them on Facebook one day. And a lot of them are like babies being washed or getting dressed up. I mean, I have friends and I've watched their children grow up from like day one to like five, and I know everything about them. So it's scary.
It's uncharted waters. This is a type of voyeurism that we really have not explored. We don't really know the impact of it, and it's sort of this ongoing experiment.
See, we want to share, you know, these milestones in our kids' lives, but I think we've forgotten how to share with the people we want to share with, and not the entire damn world. Then it becomes a popularity contest. Then it becomes an invasion of privacy, and it's a complete disservice to the children. Go ahead, Rob.
There's also the angle where these social media companies, they're advertising companies. They're powered by advertising. And if you put a child in front of it, that child has the most powerful advertising machines in the world pointed at their heads every time they're sitting in front of that app, in front of that site. So, like, before a child is old enough to have developed a proper sense of, say, media literacy or awareness of what the advertising environment is trying to do to them and, you know, how to survive that with their, you know, agency intact, you're putting your kid in front of Facebook's ad algorithms, Twitter's ad algorithms, and having their not yet completely formed brains being bombarded by that level of, high intensity advertising. And that's another whole angle, like the effect on the health of a child.
So you just ask us one question, and we'll just go forever. Okay, well, thanks for your call, and keep listening.
All right, thanks, guys. Have a good night.
Take care. I guess maybe one more call if we have time for it. 802-321-4225, because... What time did we lose our satellite window? 10 o'clock?
Yeah, we have a weather warning.
We have a call, by the way.
Wow, we've been going for a good 50 minutes here.
Yeah, it's great, you know. I like talking to listeners. And
really eclectic conversation.
Got nothing else to do. I just have a toothache here. And Rob Gila, how are you doing with your shots there? It's starting to kick in?
A little bit. It's mostly just being really low energy, which I'm sure none of you even noticed
the
difference. But no, my arm kind of hurts. But, you know, beyond that, we're okay for now. Apparently it's going to kick our ass tomorrow. We'll see.
Okay. I thought you might be asleep. That's why I asked. You know, so I think maybe it's starting to hit you a little bit, but we'll see.
A little bit.
All right, let's see who's on the line. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hey, how you doing, everybody?
How you doing? What's up?
Thank you. Thank you guys for, you know, keeping the show going the extra hour. I know it's a lot of extra work for you guys, but, you know, really appreciate hearing you.
Well, we enjoy talking to our listeners, and this is the way to do it.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Cool. So, hey, how about this? Real quick, I just came up with this. Instead of influencer, influenza.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's viral, that's for sure.
I mean, like, caretaker. I know there's a word. That it just seems, I don't know.
Yeah, we do need more words.
I did want to bring up, real quick about poisoning the data set. I have a friend she's been doing this forever. Every time she orders something from a store, she'll change, you know, the first name or the last name or she'll put, you know, male instead of female. Like every time she's signed up for things, she like changes it just slightly. And she's been onto this forever. And I've been like, oh, it's the smartest thing to do, because if they're collecting data and it's big data, just make it dirty.
Makes it wacky.
It messes everything up.
And you also find out who they're sharing with, because if that name shows up somewhere else, you know, where
yes,
did they get it from?
Right. Yes. Yeah, you can track it. It's like cookies. Wait, is it like your cookies?
Pretty much, yeah.
You're like leaving little crumbs for
homemade
your,
cookies.
Yeah, little digital cookie crumbs for yourself.
Like, we need to have our own cookies. I just wanted to follow up on something that kept coming up. A caller was calling in the last couple of weeks and talking about the car data and stuff. And there was, I just wanted to, you know, put out there was an article in Ars Technica this week or last week, a company called Ulysses. And they, you know, they say that they can get the location in real time of every car in America by 2025 or whatever. I was kind of curious about the, I think it was like 2007, there's like this Wi-Fi thing that like is required in your car to, so that your tires can tell the car when they're out of air, and that every car after that has that. And I was just wondering if you guys know more about that.
I've heard rumors of something
late in the show.
I've heard rumors of something like that. I've heard of that being developed. I'm not sure if such a thing actually exists.
What it might be doing is sharing the same spectrum, but using a specific frequency. In other words, 802.11, like that 2 gigahertz or 5 gigahertz band might be something that's, because it's public, the auto manufacturers could take advantage of that. But that's kind of dynamic and changing itself now, since so much of the infotainment and controls and sensors are evolving and becoming ever more sophisticated. So they could have sort of let go of that. It may be only a specific batch of years, but I'm not 100% sure about that.
Alex, you seem to have perked up. Do you have some information on this?
Not anymore. I think that Kyle had just relayed, but I would assume that it would be something like that, and that, you know, perhaps it would have something to do with cars passing by certain types of public infrastructure with that type of wireless technology, and then there may be some kind of a private-public partnership to sell that data or release that data, or perhaps, and I think this is something that we're going to see more of in the future as well, and I would like to see more of it as well, because it increases accountability, transparency, but the whole concept of a data escrow, where this particular type of data may be available to the public for certain types of uses, and it would be out in escrow or some sort of data trust, you know, so that if you can demonstrate to the trust that you have a legitimate, you know, non-law enforcement, non-privacy invasive use for this particular type of data, you may be able to access something like that. So I see that infrastructure and government will probably be tracking a lot more when it comes to cars, trucks, any kind of devices passing through it. Because as our caller from a couple of weeks ago noted, I think very well, the main reasoning behind this is to charge us more for the type of infrastructure that we use. So there's a very, very much a vested interest in trying to track where we go and what we use and what roads we use frequently or tolls we pass by most, because then they can tax us more about this for that particular use.
But Alex, don't you think it's mostly so that they can track us, period, whether or not they're charging us for the privilege? The fact that they're able to know where we go, where we are at, pretty much at all times, and that there's not much of a way to get out of it for people without imagination.
Oh, of course. I mean, the privacy implications of this are absolutely huge, and that's why I fear for these types of public-private projects that don't have a lot of transparency or any kind of third-party stewardship to make sure that they are doing the right thing and respecting privacy, the privacy of citizens who may unknowingly be giving this data away. And that's why I think some kind of data escrow or some kind of data trust for this type of public data or data that our governments are collecting would be a much better fit than a private contract.
I just want to add, there's going to be real importance for these schemes to be interoperable and, as you're insinuating, relatively secure, like taking care of people's stuff. And the reason that may have fallen out, if it was used for like tire pressure stuff, is the security environment itself was sort of evolving and there wasn't something standardized. That may have very well have been a way people could have accessed the vehicle network itself. There are all kinds of documented cases. I know there was one case that cars could be broken into by removing the rearview mirror, and accessing the CAN bus or some aspect of the car's computer to unlock it. And I just want to mention, for people that are interested in some of the future stuff that is going to make, that is really on a lot of vehicles now, is it's V2X, Vehicle to Everything Communication, and the standard is 802.11p. And it uses two types, as far as I can read, as WLAN or wireless LAN-based, as well as cellular-based. And this is all the kind of cool stuff that's going to come down as far as, you know, vehicles knowing where other vehicles are to kind of help with autonomous operating systems on each vehicle so that it can sense something and then send out messages to other vehicles. And they're really trying to codify this, specifically the National Highway Transportation groups in the U.S., because there is a predicted reduction in traffic accidents. There's all kinds of advantages to this going forward as we become more populous and busy out there. But it is yet to really be across the board. I mean, you have whole ages of cars, lots of different technologies out there. So it wouldn't be surprising if one particular model leaks stuff like this. And so we have to kind of share as much as we can about them. So I'm really glad you brought that up.
Cool. Yeah, it's been an issue that's kept coming up on the show the past couple weeks, and I just saw the article. I figured I'd bring it up. I also want to say on the way out, just The Hacker Crackdown by Bruce Sterling. If anyone hasn't, you know, listeners haven't read it, that totally, it's like hundreds of pages on the Night Lightning case and all that stuff. It's like the greatest.
I love that book. I read that book before I actually ever even had a computer. And I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that that book was so inspiring to me that I tracked down Bruce Sterling, the author of it. And I think it was 1994, or it might have even been 1993.
Yeah, he ruined his Thanksgiving. We've heard this story so many times that I'm sure he remembers it, too.
Thanksgiving. I red-boxed a call to him on Thanksgiving. We ended up talking for several hours. And I think at the time, the book was still under his copyright. I think he has released it to the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
And so anybody can find it online, can download it, can get the PDF. Perhaps we can even maybe tweet something out about that book.
I think that's the book where he referred to me as a dissident, and it's one of the nicest things anyone's ever said about me.
Yeah. In three syllables, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, caller, thank you for your call, and keep listening.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Your show is great. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Nice.
Well, that's going to do it for calls, I think, because it's after 9 o'clock now, Eastern Time. Not for the first time. Off the Hook Overtime is longer than Off the Hook. Imagine that. Does that happen often with baseball games that go 25 innings, or you know, when hockey used to have overtime instead of that stupid shootout thing, they used to have long games.
All right, well, then I've disabled the telephones.
The phone has been disabled.
It has been disabled.
But you can still write to us, oth@2600.com. That we don't take that down. Do we? No, we don't.
Yeah.
And again, we're not going to be on next week, because we're preempted. There's a special report to the listener, which would be interesting to hear on WBAI. But then we're on for five consecutive weeks, and that's good to look forward to.
Well, that's great. Well, my legs are getting tired, but you know, thanks to everybody who called in, made Off the Hook Overtime what it was tonight.
Yes. We will see you in a couple of weeks. Please get that vaccine. If you have the opportunity to get the vaccine, if you can help other people get appointments, please do that. Try and stop the misinformation from being spread around, and we'll get through this. We're in better shape than we were, and we're making progress, and it's through efforts of people like you. So please, dear listeners, keep it up. And Rob, Dila, I hope you feel good that the second shot doesn't affect you too badly.
Thank you. God willing. Likewise for you.
I hope my toothache goes away just in time for me to get the ache from the second shot. And I hope everybody else qualifies as soon as possible and is able to do that. Interesting period of time we're living through. But we're gonna make it. We're going to get through this.
Stay curious, y'all.
Yeah. All right. See you in a couple of weeks. Good night.